Hi, my name's Dan Seaman.
And I'm Jeremy Austin.
And welcome to the Perseen Podcast,
where we talk to industry experts and explore topics of interest to internet service providers and network experts everywhere.
Hello, and welcome back to episode 3 of the Perseen Podcast. I'm Dan Seaman, Chief Product Officer at Perseen.
And I'm co-host Jeremy Austin, Senior Product Manager.
So today at our podcast, we have kind of a couple of special guests. And what's driving this is at Wispapalooza and in general, talking to our customers, we're getting a lot of customers asking us about Toronto. And I think they're trying to understand, is this something fundamentally new? Is there like new physics or new science here? Or like, or is this kind of, you know, an improvement on the general state of the art? So to try to answer that question, we have a couple of RF experts that are going to join us today. And we're going to get probably pretty deep on some of this stuff. Hopefully not, you know, too deep, but deep enough that we can actually kind of really understand at least, you know, what's going on. I'm kind of an RF, not an RF expert, like an RF dabbler sort of. So these guys are going to be able to dig at this much deeper than I ever could for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Dan and I are the lay persons in the room here. So we're going to learn an awful lot as we talk about Toronto, which is not necessarily a newcomer in the wireless field, you know, new in release to market, but has been in development for 10 or 12 years now. I first saw their gear maybe four or five years ago. And it's been really fun to actually see some new equipment come out. Everyone has the unboxing, that new unboxing smell. And we've started to have metrics that we've been collecting on Toronto for more than a year now. And so, you know, we're getting close to being able to put out some of those metrics for the world in our upcoming fixed wireless report. So with us today, we've got Dave Cleland, learning some basic electronics in a TV repair shop at 13 years old in small town Saskatchewan. Dave's wireless telecom career officially began with Alberta Government Telephones in mobile radio in 1980. Dave is an NAIT alumni, graduating in 1987's top student in the 86-87 program, and awarded by Alberta Construction Association, has been involved as a technician in various engineering roles. Dave, I think that is absolutely putting it lightly, for 42 years, concentrating on broadband wireless for the last half of his career. I first met Dave doing Telrad training, had to be what, 2015, 2016? Yeah. How are you doing, Dave?
Maybe even 2014. Yeah, I'm doing good. Every chance I get, I hype our careers to young kids coming along now. They want a career that's going to be exciting over the next few decades. This happens to be it. This is a good one.
100%. So, the future is increasingly wireless, and fiber, we just keep extending fiber further out. The only things we disagree on is where that transition occurs. So, and with us, we also have Anton Capella. Anton's best known for his prior work in global internet routing, in security research, graph theory-based attacks against BGP, and more recently for pioneering ultra-low latency radio systems, building the first long-haul ultra-low latency network between Chicago and New York, accelerating arbitrage trading customers in the Chicago derivatives market. He presently leads the network strategy group at Cloudflare, somebody you may have heard about, a little outfit named Cloudflare, the global web security firm. Glad to have you with us, Anton.
Thanks, Jeremy. I'm really happy to be joining the call today.
Fantastic. So we'll talk a little bit about what Toronto is marketing on the specification side. Dave's pretty fresh in this. I haven't paid a ton of attention to the spec sheets myself. I did manage to catch their technical demonstration or their session, what do we call it, a animal farm in WISPA terms, last spring. And there were some things that really stood out to me at the time about, you know, the kind of niche that they're positioning their ecosystem equipment in the entire wireless ecosystem. And I want to hear, Dave, tell us a little bit about what you've learned about what they're advertising on the spec side. When I first encountered Toronto, they were still really doing point to point. And it took them some time to develop the point to multipoint, you know, the classic Wi-Fi access point, being able to communicate to multiple geographically separated clients in a time sharing system. What do they have going on, Dave?
So they call their base station a base node. They call their CPE, customer premise equipment, they call it a remote node. And the system operates in a dual carrier mode up to 40 megahertz wide channels. They use distributed massive MIMO, say that three times, on both ends. They use a six-plane multi-user MIMO, allowing them up to 256 users per sector. Their max data rate through a particular sector is 2.4 gigabits per second. And the antenna system, the integrated antenna system, is set up for four sectors per site. And so that, 2.4 times 4 equals 9.6 gigabits per site is their maximum throughput.
That's like a 90 degree equivalent of a sector.
Yes. Yes. And in this, they're using a beamforming in both directions. They call it digital beamforming in both directions. They're using what they're calling a 4D scheduler, which I have taken to understand that this would be the normal OFDM carrier times number of symbols times MU MIMO plane that communication will actually be on. So that's where I think they get the 4D name
marketing,
from.
Marketing.
Yeah. And they claim compatible timing with LTE, so they could do LTE subframe 2 mimicking. That's kind of the nutshell as to what's going on. They have an interference cancellation algorithm that's called adaptive burst interference canceller. And so that is part of that, alongside of the beamforming, is a mixed kind of the AIR protocol that they have that maybe is a little bit different than what everybody else is doing today.
Okay. But dive into what they're doing that might be different. Maybe we can have a little bit of context about the other types of radios that are using some of these techniques. So for example, I think most of us are familiar, probably many of our listeners will be familiar with the idea of MU MIMO to a couple of clients, let's say, or even working with dual polarity signals, where you're able to essentially double your system capacity by doubling the number of clients that you're talking to simultaneously. And to give a comparison, we're pretty familiar with the performance in the field of systems like Cambium's Medusa, which does 7 spatial streams horizontally and I think then 2 polarities. So it ends up being like a 7x2 system. What is 6-way MIMO in this context? I'm not sure that I understand what that means.
So I'm thinking that what they're talking about, being able to talk to up to 6 devices at the same time out in the field by using the beamforming, and these CPE would have to be spatially diverse as far as the angles and the, as far as the angle is compared to the base station. The Medusa does exactly the same thing. The Medusa will take, very familiar with that, being that Cambium is MBSI Wave's flagship product. In Medusa, depending on the distribution of your CPE out there, it will use up to those number of MU MIMO groups. But it could be that if the CPE are all bunched together, like let's say a sector pointing down a lakeshore, and you're serving all the cabins that are along the edge of the lake, you might only have 1 or 2 groups. So it's possible that you have 1 or 2 groups. It's possible that you have 5 or more groups. And I've seen systems run with in both cases with really identical RF specs. And the bottom line, as far as MIMO goes for these Tirana system, and really everything that's out there today, they're 2x2 MIMO based, right? So they divide their world up into 2 streams per CPE, and yes, they're using slant polarity, and the two streams 90 degrees in polarity apart over the air, and that's
okay. So in this context, then, you said briefly that the CPE is MIMO as well. So what's the CPE capacity toward the AP?
They claim 400 megabits.
Okay, so we could run the math on that. That's something like a 6-to-1 ratio. Does that
something
sound
like
right?
That. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So actually, the 2.4 gigabits per sector, the way I understand it, is that if we take the maximum 400 meg uplink out, then we're talking about what that would be. That would be 2 gig.
2 gig or so. Okay, because this is still a TDD system. We're still doing time splitting in the upload and download direction. And exactly. I assume because we talked about LTE compatibility, that we're dealing with fixed framing always, right?
I would think so. It says that it's compatible with the LTE frame type 2. I took that to mean when the Tirana engineer talked about that, I took that to mean that possible that they could do a 50-50 split. So they could equal the uplink and the downlink together with and they could take and do subframe two, which is 8 to 1, 10 to 1, what the actual data rate is in an LTE environment with frame two, something like that.
Yeah, I'll add on to what Dave's mentioning here. What Dave's talking about is a major, call it, split in the arrangement of what transmits when on the physical channel. In LTE, there's two major types. We all probably know about frequency duplex, frequency divided duplex systems, FDD for short, and then time duplex divided systems, that's TDD for short. Type one is what we're talking about when we talk about FDD in LTE. Generically, type two is all of the encapsulating variants of TDD. Here's the rub, and this is what's interesting to me when Dave mentions it on the spec sheet. That's saying a lot by saying very little. What's challenging here, and I wanna have our listeners understand that, is that when one is operating a TDD LTE system, there are dozens of subtypes. And it's getting more numerous and more bizarre with 5G new radio, so-called 5G NR physical layer changes. So to say that one can just casually synchronize this with something like an LTE structure suggests tremendous complexity in even accommodating something like that. And it also has one other consequence. That means it must have a similar time base. Here's where it gets crazy and terrible altogether. Unless you have GPS reference and we're all coordinated to a global UTC top dead center of a second or the rising edge of a second, we don't know where zero and time origin starts and stops, Jeremy. So is Tirana going to have a PPS input, 1588 IEEE input? Is there going to be an NTP fallback? These are all great questions on my GPS.
Currently, the GPS receiver, is built into the base station.
Right. Well, this is all great, Dave, until it fails. And I can tell you from experience, guys, most of what I deal with is red lights on dashboards for broken crap. And I can't say personally, my cohorts and compatriots and coworkers all do, of course. I have been kindly asked to not do operational work these days. But anyway, the takeaway here is this is critical, Jeremy. And then you can't understate that if you're trying to share.
You and I are ISM
spectrum in this way.
So if this is also historically, we have required fine synchronization on the AP side, can we still get away with, let's say that we have that rising edge, either one PPS or the lowest stratum we can get on the GPS side. In fact, I can think of some counterparts in the fixed wireless space, which is what we're talking about here, where they don't just receive GPS, but they also pay attention to GLONASS and some of the other systems where you want to make sure that you have backups to your backups. Does the CPE require GPS, or are they able to keep that solely on the AP side?
This is where it gets weird and interesting, and I'm sure Dave can appreciate this too. In LTE, techniques, we assume nothing of the user equipment, UE for short. I like to introduce all of our terms here, so catch me if I don't. So the UE is all phase and time locked, if you will, to what it hears over the channel. Yeah. Meaning it is relieved of having to have any kind of real long-term robust timing references internally. And as long as it can hear mothership, it's all good, it's all clear, which is another reason why the FCC says, for example, mobiles must stop transmitting if they can't hear their current, sector, base station, whatever, over 12 seconds or give or take some dwell time. So in the case of this system, in theory, similar things must apply. If the UE cannot hear base for a while, it better shut up, and so on and so forth. And if it can't synchronize because the base is clobbered by others, we don't know what the defined behavior should be. And this is where mobility faces all sorts of similar physical problems to what Tirana likely also has to face here. And that is, how much of the channel time and frequency resource do we dedicate to so-called deconflicting mechanisms to still operate if we so care to, without stable and uniform time references for all of the operating base stations in a given RF area. So big design question. In the case of Wi-Fi driven stuff, for example, we just send a frame and use the whole channel. There's no sub-channelization. There's no multi-access layers, right? Maybe Wi-Fi 6 is an exception. Right, we just fire and forget. And you can think of a Wi-Fi type structure as kind of a self asynchronously declocked, decorrelated sort of thing. Tirana flips that on its ear, and we all know how TDD stuff has to organize in this way. We can appreciate that. But the point here is that timing is really of the essence then in how this has to be constructed. And if we can find a way to reliably do that, the point is, Jeremy, that it doesn't need to be GPS everywhere. One thing we haven't seen, and this can call it quasi-prosumer consumer wireless access space, is reasonable fallback mechanisms. For example, there's been tremendous research for the last 10 years now on using NTP for sub-millisecond precisions. I'll just give a couple shout outs here. CRONI-D, complete replacement to NTPD, is great down to microsecond level precisions. And so if our backbones are relatively uncongested, you have good time sources, we don't need this extra GPS stuff. We could put devices below roof eaves and never have line of sight to any satellite constellations and still have good enough time bases to work. But do we see vendors using those as signals? No, not yet. So this is a thing that's on my mind before we even get out of the gates, Jeremy, is like, what are we doing for what time is it? And that is a big question.
And that's certainly going to be the case. If you're attempting to deploy this today in a market where you may even be running some fixed LTE yourself, I actually want to dive into this a little bit before we head on to the RF layer. You talked about like the prosumer space. Let's talk like existentially, why does Tirana exist? Like why now? Why is 4G and 5G not good enough for what we want to do? You know, we're seeing massive uptake in the fixed wireless market. Currently, it's in terms of new installs per quarter, it is eating the fiber industry's lunch in a bad way. Some of that, I'm sure, is due to supply chain issues where, you know, you're talking 24 months on lead time on fiber. Dave, I know you have a lot of experience in this field, particularly coming from the, you know, Alvarion Telrad space, where they were pretty clear about which parts of the mobility spec that they pulled out. Can I get your perspective on that? Because that's what Anton has said is the first time I've heard somebody apply the word prosumer, which you normally think of as like consumer electronics, to the infrastructure space. So I'd love to get your opinion on that. I mean, then both of you can talk about this, right? But let's look at kind of the historical picture briefly, and then where Tirana fits into this, because it definitely is a higher price point than some people might have been expecting, but lower than say a full Nokia Ericsson system.
Yes. And so I think that there's two things that are going on here, and it has to do with ownership of the infrastructure. The faster that a service provider today can own infrastructure, I think, and secure the customer, that's kind of the goal to provide service in an area, right?
You don't mean necessarily like vertical assets, because often that's leased, but
I'm talking about a little bit higher than this. Let's go a little bit philosophical. And if we think of a customer as a group of underserved or not served people out there, then today there is a movement that's being fostered by government grants and all kinds of things to take in and get service to these underserved areas and underserved people or not served people, and be able to take and treat the internet connectivity as though it's a utility, just like water, sewer, power, whatever, right? And so that's the movement.
So why is mobile not sufficient for this?
So what's that?
Why is mobile not sufficient for this?
Oh, because I think that it's a case of an infrastructure that you don't own. If you and I, Jeremy, were going to go start an internet service provider business, we'd have a choice to make. One would be to take and sell somebody else's service and make a commission off of it, or the other would be to own the infrastructure and hopefully make something that we can, you know, break even or make a little bit more on.
Let's consider it from the end customer's perspective, not the ISP's perspective, which is my natural perspective is to look at it from the ISP's, you know, having spent years in it. But is it just simply that there is not enough spectrum in mobility available? Because, you know, everybody, as soon as you get home, you want to get on the Wi-Fi, right? You want to offload those bits.
I think there's not enough spectrum everywhere. I think that we've been crammed into narrow channel bandwidths for a very long time. With the history of our business is that voice circuit or voice system was good enough. So 4K. So that translated into radio into be a 12.5 kilohertz or a 25 kilohertz channel. Now all of a sudden, so you take a 9600 bit per second modem that you can run over a 4K channel, everything's fine. But you know the days of that are long gone, because now we want video, we want everything to be, we demand all of this bandwidth, and so now we've got to take and provide, you know, multi megabits, right? And we're talking about
and multi gig now too.
Multi gig now, exactly.
Yeah. So the problem is lack of spectrum. Then is our only answer to just simply increase efficiency?
From a physics perspective, I believe that's the case. We have to increase the efficiency, or we have to fundamentally take and move up in frequency and down in range and increase the density of what we have.
Which is what happens when you get on
perspective by doing that. Yes. Yeah. That's our two choices.
I'm going to take this as a cue, Dave, to kind of follow on your point about the physics aspects here. And I want to start, Jeremy, by first saying, sharing a little bit about what we learned in the long haul microwave work between Chicago and New York. What basically you're fighting at any layer of radio, I shouldn't say layer, whatever you're wanting to do with communications systems, you're implicitly what we call band limited. Band limited means I have definite, call it countable spectrum that I can use. We're not talking about ultra wideband and weird voodoo stuff. We're talking about like occupied bandwidth that is defined and knowable. And from there we
work like a Shannon communications channel.
Exactly. So think of like a, you know, abstract in your mind, picture in your heads here as we're saying this, you know, just a frequency N and then N plus some countable amount. Let's call it N plus K. And in that band occupancy, we now have a problem. We cannot go beyond it. And to make this system work well at all, we have to have what we call a filter. Mm-hmm. That could be a circuit, or it could be a digitally modeled equivalent of the same componentry. And it could achieve essentially the ability to limit us to N at the low end to N plus K at the high end. And when we do that, we now start whacking away at our margins. We start doing the first bad thing to our system. We have potentially now spread energy over time. We have so-called intersymbol interference that we create as a consequence of filtering. And anyone that can appreciate kind of an audio metaphor knows that no equalizer, audio right. equalizer is free, for example. You right. have so-called pre-echo, you have, you know, impulse smearing, all kinds of negative things as a consequence of this band-limited regime that we must work in.
Right.
So as a physics radio person, we work against that. We try to find ways to exploit mathematical subtleties to minimize intersymbol interference, or balance them perhaps, the sender and the receiver, so they sum out to net zero. But all of the things we're talking about here, Jeremy, chip away at our starting point, our maximum, what we call dynamic range of the system.
Okay.
And no matter what we do, let's say we want to get more bits arbitrarily through a channel. We could do clever things to exploit decoding intricacies in a receiver that has more than one receiving path. And as Dave mentions, Tirana, like many, has a cross-polarized dual polarity array in the UE and in the base station. And so we use cross-polarization just to get better separation. We don't do it because we can't decode two streams spatially that are, you know, somewhat decorrelated in scattering terms. We do it because it's easier than the math, okay? And it's easier than having a higher precision, higher quantizer precision A to D. So what we're getting at here in summary to say, Jeremy, is that we are in any system you look at, mobility, fixed, nomadic, what have you, we are what we call receiver limited. That is yeah. it. The best you can do is what this thing can detect against all the other sort of, you know, chaotic energy and noise sources and everything else in the environment in total. That's it. So whether it's in-channel, you know, thermal noise from preamps and resistors and filters and antennas and everything else being hot. When I say hot, I mean like not, you know, absolute zero Kelvin.
Right.
We're at like, you know, hundreds of Kelvin because we're not frozen dead. So these are warm systems. And at real temperatures we operate, there's just noise everywhere. We can't get past it. Let me give you an example here. And Dave is going to love this. Like if you think about the noise floor of a 20 megahertz wide channel, it's not quiet. It's like negative 96 dB, give or take. Right. That is noisy as heck. And you throw a 12 or 16 or whatever bit DAC at that, okay, great. I can quantize noise all day. But what do I have left in that distribution of data? Well, I might have some signal. I might have some intentional signal from my user. I got a lot of other unintentional signals as well. And how do I tease it all out? Well, the receiver has the task. And that's it. The better I can do, the more math I can throw at it, the better maybe my chances of decoding it are. In terms of beamforming and capacity and everything else, we've talked before, Jeremy, about, you know, what would it take to get gigabit over a 20 megahertz channel? Well, you know, 18 or 16 dB SNR with 8 spatial streams is all it takes to get a gigabit of uncoded bandwidth at 20 megahertz wide. Here's a consequence. If I stacked 8 signals that were all spatially multiplexed, I got to have enough to decode them separately. That right. implies 80 plus dB of dynamic range. I can't do that at 80 mega samples. I mean, I'm back. So I was
thinking for a while that we were somewhat limited by like amplifier distortion, you know, on the transmit side, because of the race to higher and higher modulations, you know, right, where you could only output 1024 QAM if you dropped your max down. And then we saw some really hot head ends like Dragon Wave, for example, which is a great name for that, where they were able to output at, you know, 2048 at plus 29 dB, right? So you're saying that, you know, we've made enough improvements on the transmit side that now we are just simply receiver limited?
I will argue two things. The recent innovations, and I borrowed a lot of these in New York, Chicago, in what we call digital pre-distortion compensation, so-called non-linear modeling of gain devices being the amplifiers you're talking about.
Right.
If I can get every last milliwatt of useful conducted power out of that circuit, it's at a consequence generally of distortion products and negative consequences thereof, because now I interfere and I waste power out of channel. The magic math that finally got cheap enough to minimize those analog ailments is what we call pre-distortion. And at higher and higher dynamic ranges, this problem gets exceedingly challenging. This becomes quickly non-polynomial, okay? And that's where we go off into the weeds, and you could throw GPUs at it. You could throw more power at it than you are conducting and still not get more benefit. Is the negative trade-off.
There are hard limits there on that side.
Yeah. So basically, if you have a signal that's only, say, 10 to 12 dB peak to average ratio, peak to average power ratio is a key thing that you'll hear me talk about throughout this entire session today. If your peak to average ratio is reasonably contained, you can now start to engage in clever techniques to pre-distort the signal and minimize the analog distortion products out of the amplifier finally. Once you get to that point of efficiency, you have to stay there. You can't go to higher index modulations. You can't go to higher subcarrier packings because that makes the peak to average ratio even worse. So there's some balance to be had there. If it's like 1,000 subcarriers, let's forget how many there are. Let's talk about how many kilohertz or hertz are in each one, and then ask how many overall megahertz you want to occupy. So if we're talking relatively narrow occupied bandwidth, say under 5 or 10 megahertz, having thousands of subcarriers is great up till you can't tell them apart, up till they're not orthogonal anymore. And so we're kind of, call it integration limited, Fourier limited in that way. And then at the same time, how much dynamic range do we have for our pre-distortion circuit? It has to learn and constantly make adjustments to the actual analog behaviors in circuit multiple times a second, and then average those together to make real adjustments on the minute-to-minute time scale. Again, things are hot, and the temperatures don't stay the same. So as all of these circuits get hot and cold all day long, imagine a pre-distortion circuit has to track that essentially minute-to-minute. This is hard, actually. So this is where you hit that wall on the transmit side. Okay, so at some point, we're going to get max efficiency for our parts, and that's what we got. We're going to hit that wall at the coding level we have, or the modulation index.
Let's talk about the efficiency of the gear itself. You know, like what is theoretically possible? You know, Dave, I was remembering back, this is what I think 2015 or 16 as well, when we saw a new entrant into the field of point to point, and that was Mimosa. And Mimosa had going for it, well, A, in the point to multipoint space, they were able to get to market with the 256 QAM product, point to multipoint, prior to Cambium. They beat Cambium to market on that. Yeah. And on their licensed product, they did some kind of unusual things with full spectrum utilization, since it was a TDD product, go back to what Anton was saying earlier, rather than an FDD, as most point to point, in fact, all the point to point microwave systems were FDD at that point. Transmit in one direction, receive in the other, and then you didn't have to worry about you could just do it with the filter split, right?
Sure.
And the advantage of Mimosa at the time, and it's still an advantage in some places, like they still have some real devotees, is that they were a relatively low power system and only moderate efficiency. They were aiming for the most possible efficiency. So when you took a double wide channel, because they were able, using a Wi-Fi chipset, right, to go ahead and you could go ahead and get pretty much as much spectrum as you could find in your area and get a reasonable amount of capacity out of that. So that was an example of the success of a system that wasn't aiming for maximum efficiency. And this is related to what Anton was saying about distortion here. In the realm of Tarana, are they trying to aim for like what I think of as the Medusa approach, which is just multiplex more and more channels together of lower efficiency, or are they taking a different approach? And and how are they achieving, if they are achieving fantastic results in the field? You know, some people will say that they are. We will put out results on that eventually. What exactly are they doing to achieve it, and what's possible?
So to Anton's point about the channel itself, once we're limited to edges of a channel, then problem of stuffing the channel, it becomes more and more critical all the time. And the more that we multiplex, the more signal to noise ratio that we need to be able to do that. By doing that, since we're legislated in our continent to a certain amount of power in a certain band, we can't exceed that power. So therefore, we have to shorten the range or do something with the range in order to take in and achieve this amount of energy that we're receiving, right, over top of the noise that's there. And the more we multiplex, the more noise we generate ourselves. And okay. Yeah, it's a bit of a circle.
Like a diminishing returns at some point?
At some point. And so I think the trend in the past has been that manufacturers achieve this average amount of efficiency. LTE, for example, 2x2 MIMO LTE is about 5.5 bits per second per hertz. That's right. That's you know, the kind of the number. You can play with it, you can do tricks, and you can get it up to somewhere around 10. When Medusa came out, and you have a fully developed system, and that you approach 20 or a little bit more, yeah, bits, right, per second per hertz. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's probably today, with the electronics that we have, I think that's probably the limit, because we can't do anything with the noise. Like, right, we are so many degrees Kelvin, and so there's so much smoke, so much noise. So, and
is Toronto claiming higher bits per hertz than that?
I haven't calculated that. I don't know that they're claiming it. Yeah, from a marketing perspective, they're claiming it. But I don't know exactly from what's really going on out there, what they're actually going to achieve. So we'd have to take this two gigabits per second. For example, backwards into the TDD split, whatever that timing is, and if we assume that it's going to be LTE like they claim on the spec sheet here, then you know, we've got some references that we can take and work this backwards to, and they're probably, the numbers that are here are probably in the 40 bits per second per hertz range of, I would think, if I do this math in my head. And I think that's just the case of this adaptive burst interference canceller and the MU MIMO properly deployed, I guess,
where you actually install the customers is going to affect the
capacity. For sure. Absolutely. For sure. It is for sure. And the other thing I think that's important here is the fact that we have to know for sure that the range is not unlimited. The area that you can cover here is a finite area. And
understood. They are claiming greater range than previous products, because, like, you can burn it either way. You can either burn your total system capacity in supplying, you know, bigger plans to people that are closer in, or slower plans to people that are further out. There's no doubt about that.
That's always the give and take.
Right. And in field tests, you know, in terms of what we've seen in terms of published reports, people are definitely claiming they can go further, you know, on this. So what are some of the possible reasons for this, or what are some of the potential pitfalls? I mean, Anton, I know you're champing at the bit here.
Well, I was going to back into the same thing that Dave's talking about from a different direction. If you look at the filings, and I'm sure the listeners can, you know, do this on their own and go to the FCC OET and pull it, like, just like I did, you'll see that the Toronto devices today are using what we call merchant silicon for one of the critical components in the transmit receive chain. And that's just the transceiver chip that goes from, you know, the over the air modulated frequencies, you know, roughly 5 gigahertz band, to digital baseband and back. And so imagine this part that I'm talking about here is the critical link from the analog domain and on into and from the antenna systems, and then back to whatever can interpret that signal and result in and decode meaningful data from it. So on that part's face, on the spec face of itself, we see a maximum of 8 transmit receive analog paths and 160 megahertz of usable channel bandwidth. The Nyquist bandwidth, rather, being 160. So if we think about efficiency, and the question you asked earlier, Jeremy, if we start with a 2.4 gigabit maximum PHY potential in terms of density, packing, everything else, and if we go into splitting this down and down and down, if we have, you know, six beamformable layers, okay, and 160 megahertz to throw that into and reuse uniformly completely, and then finally divide this down into a number of bits per hertz per second. I think we're only looking at 2.5 bits per hertz per second for 6 layers per total. So this is not even in a single polarity. So for example, okay, if we could get something on right slant, left slant, we're only talking a bit and some change per hertz per second to get 6 streams up to some at about 2.4 gigabits if we have 160 megahertz to burn.
Right.
Which
to be fair, they, Tirana is, they do, they are field testing that today, and they're right, bringing out, you know, their G1 X2, I think, is the second generation, which is going to basically allow you dual 80s. And, and what you're saying about the chip makes sense because they're claiming that they're going to backfeed this feature into the existing hardware.
Right. Yeah. So that's exciting. And that's only trying to get a couple, that's like basically, you know, something between BPSK, QPSK per polarity, per terminal, per layer. I can't even say layer. I don't want to say layer because as I understand this encoding, this is explicit digital beamforming. When I say explicit, I mean feedback-based closed loop. What I mean by that is you use, Jeremy, I think the popular terms are zero forcing and still, maximum likelihood. So imagine decomposing the beamforming problem into just a question of which vectors sum for the given set you want to transmit to the point you are transmitting them to, and working backwards. So whatever math approach you use to subdivide the problem, whether it's a zero forcing thing, i.e. finding frequency equalization that is zeroed out between the endpoints versus maximum likelihood, which is to say, whatever the log sum is of all symbols that would be incident at that receiver, whatever path you take down the branch of math for that is up to the implementer. And your results are critically limited by it. That's the thing I want to emphasize here. This is only going to get useful capacities that they're describing with the wind at your back, if you will, and everything going for you in a pretty static, stable environment. Nothing moving, nothing driving around, that kind of thing.
Okay, so because they definitely you know, stress in their in their literature and in the presentation that I saw of the, you know, the kind of the awesome power of equalization that they have going on here, and in some of those tests it really does seem that that's true, where, you know, they really are able to take advantage of true multipath in ways that previous systems have not been able to do. So can you talk a little bit more about, like, what are the, you said with the wind at our back, so, you know, with the God willing and the creek don't rise. Well, as everybody knows in wireless, the creek rises. What happened?
Quick clarifying question though. Like, you mentioned things not moving. Did you mean the actual radios not moving, or not things not moving in the environment? Like trees blowing in the wind.
Largely stationary.
All of it. Everything. Yeah. Anything that changes the path vector sum, the set of all path vectors for all frequencies, that's what we're talking about. So let me back into that one, Dan, by answering a little bit of this to compare it to or other build from the Medusa thing we mentioned earlier. Let's look at Medusa real quick. Short summary here, and that is it's a corporate feed that is a fixed phase network of multiple transmit receive chains into a fixed array of antennas. So there is no digital beam forming as such. There is no closed loop feedback. This is what we call an open loop corporate feed beam forming system, for lack of a better compact term. There isn't one yet. We could invent one here, seeing folks, but that's not
they
your
call it beam forming, to be fair. You don't really call it beamforming.
Exactly. It's kind of like a subsectorization concept, right, if you will. And the cool thing, and the reason I'm mentioning it this way, to me, the best feature that they efficiently got out of this is arbitrary headroom. You don't have an analog problem when you're simply doing corporate phase networks to interface antenna elements into a set of defined ports for your transmit receiver devices to then communicate over. Second thing that helps them do this really well is just being simply stated TDD. There's no real big crosstalk problem. There's no leakage problem. So you have all the stuff lined up to make Medusa work really well. And it doesn't take a lot to disturb it. And we see folks with any kind of scattering environments and rich multipath environments not getting the sort of throughputs that we can see theoretically with their parking lot demonstration, for example. And that's a key distinction here. When you have a fixed corporate phase network, all of the incident ray paths must be consistent to all the end nodes, or they don't see the same beams. They don't see the same array construction. And that's just a sad fact of physics. This is how it is.
Yeah. If when the wind blows the trees around, you're going to get some scattering.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So we don't. So consequently, of course, no one would try, or no one would go along into, you know, a reduced type system in an anonymous site environment. It just doesn't. It's not compatible with your aims, right?
Right.
So in the case of Tirana, building from that concept, we throw all of that away. There is no analog phase corporate network at all in this system. It is all inputs and outputs into an ADC DAC transceiver. The on semi part we talked about, and it immediately goes over digital baseband, some sort of high speed interface to their own ASICs, their own silicon, which the company reportedly has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on over the course of the last decade. That's astounding. And here's where this gets back to the economics we discussed earlier, a little bit or hinted at. This is that mid prosumer thing I'm talking about. There's no ITU helping drive this. There's right. No spectrum built coordination of knowing self from not self. There's no way to structurally guarantee that the interference and wayward signals it encounters are going to be recognizable at all. They're going to be energy, and they're going to come from some vector direction, and they're going to have some scattering and delay components. Mm-hmm. That's all we're going to know. So what we're left with is a pile of bits off that ADC chip, and we're going to have to sort through all of those and figure out what Tirana, what we are, what self is, and then subtract, hopefully, the things that aren't self in a stable, easy, repeatable, compressible manner in the digital processing side. And that might take teraflops effectively. And so it goes. And so we see
the need for the ASIC.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so we see tens of or 50 or 60 watts of power to do that compared to the consumer stuff. I'm just gonna whitewash it all and say, like, you know, merchant silicon that came from laptops and found its way into Ubiquiti and others is, you know, Atheros is Broadcom, is what you want to call a $2 part, right? And those just don't do that sort of thing. It's all integrated. Direct conversion, ADC, DAC, broadband, yep. Amplification, everything's right. On chip pretty much at this point. Maybe some pre-selection or external, you know, brick wall band selection filtering is external. But nonetheless, that's a way different operational goal than what we're talking about with Tirana. And that's, again, a middle bar, if you will, between the high end, let's call it global mobility first approaches to doing radio communication systems. But within that spectrum, call it that spread of goals here, of aims, Tirana's in this interesting and challenging middle part. And that's where, you know, you have to ask some questions. Why would someone try that? Why do they believe this is a good efficiency? We could take what we see with LTE TDD and use mode 7 and mode 8, you know, closed loop beamforming, and we could have inordinate amounts of capacity. We know this. I mean, T-Mobile's got it deployed on, you know, 2.5 gig EBS across the country right now, across the majority of the service area. And it's tremendous. It's amazing capacity. And it works really, really well with a $2 UE chipset or whatever, you know, low bomb.
You're really having to deal with self-interference, right?
But the point there is self-interference is determinable. You know self because you have pilot signals that are all orthogonal. Every base station barks mm-hmm. out every couple symbols, sub-symbols rather, every so many microseconds within the subframe itself. We're talking like, you know, 60, 70, you know, microsecond long symbol times. And groups of 12 of them could be a resource element in LTE. And in these sort of, you know, fine-grained overlapping emissions, the UE has explicit information rather from all other potentially hearable point sources in the environment. And then at the UE's ability to process and call it deconvolve that, it can model the interferers tremendously straightforwardly, basically implicitly straightforward. So you can't do that unless you build those features into your system. The question for Tirana folks and for folks wanting to design a similar system is how much overhead will you account for and allow in your physical layer? And in the case of Tirana and broadband wireless, we want almost none. We want our cake and to eat it
right,
too.
Right. Exactly.
We want all frames, all spectrum and time resources to go to user bits, not system right. overhead bits. Right.
Right. Right.
So the question, finally, though, of limiting the system resources, if we could throw more and more power, again, we're not paying for it. The customers pay for the power right. at their user side. You're paying for your Starlink terminal, and I know it's like 80 to 120 watts just to have the dish on and do nothing. But I take it on the chin as a customer because too late. So if we had the same sort of assumptions into our user side for Tirana or any other system, I mean, the limit, again, is receiver driven. If the receiver has, you know, arbitrarily low noise floor, arbitrarily good bandwidth parts, and can arbitrarily reject more and more spurious signals that we know are not self, then the capacities just go up and up and up correspondingly. Organizing a system around that assumption, that's the marketing challenge. And so how do we get someone to buy into that you know, kind of mid-band where it's real kind of fixed function. You can't take it on the road. It doesn't interoperate with anything else. It's its own beast. And what's the value prop? Who really knows? You know, that's the question from the engineering mind that I have when I look at it.
Sure. And that does lead us into what I think can be our last question. So Dave, you know, where do you see this, you know, really being successful? We talked, you know, Anton just talked a little bit about the power requirements. I agree. That was one of the questions that came up in the session that I was attending where someone was saying, you know, this seems like a lot of power for a single radio. And Tarana's counterpoint to that was saying, well, you are expected to be replacing this many radios in terms of capacity, and you should be able to run those numbers and see whether that makes sense for you. Similarly, you know, we talk about, you know, the success that we're seeing in Milliwave, which is let's gut up really close and personal with our customer versus this kind of mid-range, you know, let's say that the Tarana market is a little bit, you know, it's more non-line of sight potential customer than we'd be dealing with Medusa. It's not probably not as non-line of sight as say a 4G or 5G system. What do you see that being? Clearly the sweet spot was when the customer isn't actually paying for it because it is a spendy at this point. If the government is the customer, then who cares? But what do you see in terms of applicability, Dave?
So I think that the sweet spot for equipment like Tarana's here is in that area where you're subscriber density can be high enough that you can put enough load on one of these sectors that you can start to justify that cost. I think that for, you know, we're used to broadband wireless in the rural areas for LTE and other things where densities are really, really low. The system is relatively inexpensive, using Mimosa's example before, and even Cambium's EP&P and others that are Wi-Fi based, AU211 based, they're very inexpensive. And so you put it out, you have a really low density, the operator can still make some money at it and provide a reasonable service at a reasonable cost. This is competing against the installation and cost of fiber to the premise. And so that's its competition here, I think, is it's a different kind of thing. And so the place where this is going to shine is where you've got a reasonable density that's still maybe too low for a fiber to the premise play today. But you need to deploy quickly, and you need to you have this market that's available to you out there. I personally, believe in the priority of fiber and wireless. I have fiber in my own house, my lab here. And if somebody came along and offered me a wireless system like this, I probably wouldn't take it now that I've got fiber. But if I didn't have fiber, then and I was dealing with something that, you know, 5 or 10 megabits worth of a service level, and an operator came along and said, "Do you want this for, you know, 100 or 150 bucks a month or whatever it's going to be able to pay for a system like this?" I would probably say, yeah. And so that, I think, is the market. I think that's the business plan, from what I can see for this kind of system. When we get away from the pure technical talk about it, the business plan here is that it can provide, a multi-hundred megabit service, potentially. They claim 3 to 5 kilometers here at non-line of sight. And so what's that? One to 3 miles. And so that's the draw a circle on the map, and you have enough subscribers in there to be able to make this pay, then this is probably the right system to deploy. Absolutely. In discussions that I've had over the last few months, now that we have been able to market this ourselves here as a distributor, that's the discussion comes to a point at some point in time when can I make some money with it or not? That's really the bottom line.
Absolutely. Anton, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the vision and just what I've heard and known and seen in the market and press about the notion and what Tarana has been doing, you know, since its inception, is that this perceived middle space is underserved and can get some traction if we had something that gets just over the threshold of interesting. And so that's a tough one. I I'm a bad marketer, and I'm not sensing that, you know, the price point's just right yet for that. I think we still see lots of examples where it was crossover, call it down, maybe movement down from the LTE type spaces into these frequency ranges that can just work just as well. and maybe have a higher volume behind them to intersect the price point more rapidly. I think the bet, though, from what I can see, and I hope it works out, is that they can meet this sooner. And if there's enough of a boost, call it early interest from funding-driven things, federally reallocated sorts of things, then maybe it's worth that gamble, is my assumption on it. Now, where that puts me is I want it so badly to work, actually, because this is the only example of something that, as I mentioned earlier, depending on your perspective, is not ITU driven. And that is so great. It's not 3GPP encumbered. And right. That's so great, because now any good idea could get into code really quick. Whether or not, here's what I'm going to say, Jeremy. The question of the goodness depends on who's in charge of that physical and Mac layer development.
Right.
And if they're really interested in getting every last bit and applicability and kind of efficiency out of it, then they will probably win. We see this everywhere else. And so the hypothesis here that we can share and take away is that, the internet in general only just works. If you make a unicorn, no one cares, right? IP doesn't solve congestion problems, as Preseem likely well knows, and TCP also doesn't on its own solve global congestion problems. And so here you are fixing it. What do you think about, we can do with that sort of mentality and philosophy in radio? Tirana might be that break we need in the call it the wireless armor of baking intellectual property into ASICs, which is, Wi-Fi sadly is that. You can't just change how it fundamentally works. Even if it is a soft core on someone's vague silicon these days. If we had a system that wasn't IEEE driven, it wasn't, again, 3GPP driven, then we have to ask some new questions. And if we're not asking that stuff, it's not exciting, and maybe it's not, maybe it's too good already. Maybe it's not just working enough to interest the rest of us into fixing it. I think that's a real question here. Can it be just good enough to work, but also get all of our attention and work on it? And here we are talking about it, ironically enough. So
right.
Here he has, Jeremy.
That's fantastic. I love that perspective. And in a sense, Wi-Fi has been, the great success of wireless, where it's just worked well enough. It's still a pain point, but as I said, in most cases, you get home, you want to get on the Wi-Fi. Dave, anything you want to plug, and how can we reach you?
So you can reach me at support@mbsiwave.com, or my personal email is dclelland@mbsiwave.com. And I'd be happy to field any discussion or anything else that drives from this podcast. This is really really an awesome hour.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Dave. That's mbsiwave.com, correct?
Correct. No E on the end. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Anton, how about you?
My plug has to go to Cloudflare for being the most flexible employment place I've ever worked before, schedule-wise. So props to my team and crew around for doing that, letting me have the time here to talk to you all today. And then my best contact email address is tcapella@gmail.com, tcapela@gmail.com.
Awesome. I'm Jeremy at preseem.com, and Dan is dan@preseem.com. Send us any questions to our email. Podcast is available anywhere that podcasts are sold, right? You can subscribe to us on Spotify and in the Apple Store as well. I do want to mention again, as I said at the top of the show, that we do have our fixed wireless report coming out real soon. We will be distributing that URL where you can sign up to get that as soon as that is available. And in that report, we've been putting this out for a number of years now, kind of the state of fixed wireless. How well are fixed wireless operators doing at meeting their customers' demands? And with the things that everybody really loves is these hardware comparisons. How well does hardware do one against another? We're here to be vendor neutral, but we do tell the truth as we see it. So thanks for hanging out with us for this last hour. Dan, any last words?
No, thanks, guys. That was great. Much of the low-level stuff went over my head, but I think it's really interesting to think about what they're doing that's just different than everyone else and how that might play in the industry. So, yeah, thanks for your time. It's fantastic.
Yeah, thank you both. It's been really fun to talk, not just the hardware, but the philosophy of fixed wireless and what's going on in the space. And please come again.